Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum. We're a venue for spoken word presentations in many forms. We feature writers, artists, storytellers, and thinkers recorded at events around Seattle. I'm your host, John O'Brien. It's fair to say that dire warnings about climate change have become the new normal. Consider these recent headlines from NASA's climate change blog. July 2nd, Turkish glaciers shrink by half. June 16th, study, a third of big groundwater basins in distress. May 14th, it's the final act for Larsen B ice shelf. April 30th, longer melt season a game changer for Arctic mammals. So when I say a philosopher and an atmospheric scientist walk into a bar, you shouldn't expect a great punchline. That did happen recently at Columbia City's Royal Room. The philosopher was Professor Lauren Hartzell Nichols. She teaches environmental ethics and lectures in the philosophy department at the University of Washington. The scientist was atmospheric sciences professor Thomas Ackerman. He directs UW's Joint Institute for the Study of the Atmosphere and Ocean. Humanities Washington brought them together for one of their Think and Drink events to ponder the big picture reality of climate change and whether or not technology can help prevent climate disaster. Here in Washington State, scientists project that average annual temperatures will rise almost 2 degrees by the 2020s and almost 3 degrees by the 2040s, compared to averages from the 70s through the 90s. They predict the temperature rise will be accompanied by extreme weather conditions, reduced snowpack, and rising sea levels. Governor Jay Inslee's carbon reduction proposal, the Carbon Pollution Accountability Act, hasn't made it out of committee. The program would set a cap on carbon emissions and require the state's biggest emitters to buy pollution permits. A consortium of New England states enacted a similar program in 2005, the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. The program has helped reduce emissions from power plants by half and raised over $1 billion for participating states. Environmental groups in Washington are poised to introduce a ballot initiative on carbon reduction in 2016 if lawmakers don't act. Professors Lauren Hartzell Nichols and Thomas Ackerman spoke at the Royal Room on June 30, 2015. Humanities Washington's Zaki Barak Hamid served as moderator. Thanks to Kevin Mitchum for our recording.
Our panelists here today, we have Lauren Hartzell Nichols. Lauren is a professor of environmental ethics at University of Washington. She began her interdisciplinary training in environmental studies at Connecticut College and completed her PhD in the philosophy department at Stanford University. Lauren's work addresses the ethical challenges of climate change and particularly the complexity of ethical decisions decision-making in the face of significant intergenerational risks. Thank you, and welcome, Lauren.
Thank you.
We also have Mr. Thomas Ackerman. Tom is the director of the Joint Institute for the Study of Atmosphere and Ocean and professor of atmospheric sciences at the University of Washington. He is also the recipient of the NASA Distinguished Public Service Medal. That's what I got right before he did. and also the Leo Szilard Award for Science in the Public Interest awarded by the American Physics Society. Welcome, Tom. All right, so we're going to talk about climate change. We're going to talk about geoengineering. So we thought we wanted all of us here to be on the same page before we dive into these ethical questions and scientific questions. So to do that, we have a few slides we want to just get through so we're all on the same page. We're going to have a couple of slides about climate change in general and then get into geoengineering, and then we'll get to the meat, so to speak. All right, so I'll kick it off to you, Lauren, first, and if you want to go ahead and give us a little primer.
Sure. So I'm going to be talking just a little bit about climate change. I assume most of you know something about climate change by now. But just to make sure we're on the same page. So we have a wonderful sun out there. It's in my lovely picture here from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change slides. So the sun shoots a whole bunch of solar radiation at us. And not all of it makes it to the surface. We have this wonderful atmosphere surrounding us, which I'm going to talk about in a second. But that atmosphere actually deflects some sunlight back into space before it even gets to us. But then some sunlight makes it to our lovely warm planet, and the way that it stays so warm is that our atmosphere, which to use a horrible but functional analogy, is like a big warm blanket, right? And it re-radiates a bunch of that heat around the surface, and that's what keeps us warm. So it leaves in a longer wavelength than it comes in. So the issue with climate change is that by increasing the concentrations of greenhouse gas in the atmosphere, we're basically increasing the heat rating on that blanket. So we're trapping more heat near the surface, which is slowly over time warming our planet. Right? This is called the greenhouse effect. And the reason that matters is because, on average, global surface temperature is increasing around the world. And that's having all kinds of derivative effects. So if you can hit my next slide. The light's a little funky, but what you're going to see on, I'm a little dyslexic, the left side there, is a graph that's, the black line is representing the change that we've seen in global average surface temperature so far. And the red line is graphing a scenario of significantly increased concentrations of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere over the next 100 years, whereas the blue line is graphing a significant decrease in at least the emissions of greenhouse gases, basically a steadying off, a leveling off of the concentrations of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. So the moral of the story here is that the more greenhouse gases we emit into the atmosphere, the warmer on average our planet is going to get. Right? The sooner we can get that in check, the lower down we'll be on that graph. Why does this matter? Right? Why is this an ethical issue? It's because temperature change, while in and of itself can be harmful in some ways, there's all kinds of other derivative effects. So this other part of the graph on the right here is what's called the burning embers diagram. And what it's illustrating is the level of risk that we're going to experience with different amounts of increased global surface temperature. So what it's categorizing is five different, what the IPCC calls reasons for concern, so things that we should be worried about when it comes to climate change. So the first thing is unique and threatened systems. So the gray line on there, I know it's a little hard to see, is showing where we already are. So we've already seen a little bit over a half degree centigrade increase in global average surface temperature. And so, for example, we're already seeing really unique systems threatened by climate change, right? We're seeing vulnerable plant species being affected by climate change. But as we increase in temperature, the risk of, for example, extreme weather events like hurricanes, the risk of having more intense and more frequent hurricanes goes up. As we move farther across on that picture, we see that there's an increased risk of what's called large singular events, so things like the melting of the West Antarctic ice sheet or changes in circulation, which could have really devastating effects in our oceans. And have effects on land as well. But the point here is that the reason that climate change is an ethical issue is because it threatens things that we value, right? Change in and of itself isn't bad. What's bad is that a lot of people are going to be really harmfully affected the more increase in surface temperature we see. So what we're talking about today is the different ways in which we can affect that system, right? What can we do about this? So the two most common categories of responses are mitigation and adaptation. So mitigation, it's actually really horribly named. Abatement would be a better term, because mitigation isn't about mitigating the change, if we were to use the literal interpretation of the word. It's actually about trying to prevent it from getting worse than it has to be. So mitigation is about affecting the human actions that are causing climate change. So that means reducing greenhouse gas emissions, reducing deforestation, which is another major driver of climate change. And then on the back end, adaptation, which I have in green here, is about addressing climate impacts. So again, climate impacts of themselves, right, changes aren't necessarily harmful. It's the ways in which those changes affect people, right, and things that we value. So an example of adaptation would be building a seawall around a city, or migrating people inland, or developing infrastructure to deal with water availability, freshwater resource availability, right, if we're going to have changes in precipitation patterns. But what we're really concerned about today is this middle box, which is in blue, which is called climate engineering. So there's this idea that in addition to dealing with climate change kind of on the front end with mitigation and on the back end with adaptation, what if we could actually engineer solutions that affect the climate system itself? And there's two major categories here, which Tom's going to speak to in a second. And the first idea is that we could deflect more of that incoming solar radiation through what's called solar radiation management. So to offset the fact that we have that increase, right, blanket around us, the increase in kind of re-radiation of solar radiation that's keeping it, getting the planet overly warm, let's deflect some solar radiation before it gets here to kind of offset that balance. That's the first idea. And then the second idea is what's called carbon dioxide removal or carbon dioxide management. And the idea that maybe we could artificially pull some carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, so not, you know, change the drivers of emissions, but actually pull it back out as a way to try and stabilize the climate. So the one thing I want to make sure to highlight is that almost no one is saying climate engineering should be the only solution to climate change. The question we're asking today is, should it be part of our kind of range of solutions or ways of addressing climate change? So Tom's going to tell us a little bit more.
As Lauren just said, there's two kinds of climate engineering that we talk about. The one on the bottom or on the left-hand side is carbon dioxide removal. And in some sense, this is what we would all prefer to do. It's to remove, if we decided the climate's too warm, the way to cool it down would be to remove CO2. There are some things on there that are pretty simple, like reforestation, but don't actually affect the budget that much. We can also talk about capture and storage.
Why don't I take over a second? Okay, so some other things we can do there. You take a second, and then you tell me when you want to take back over, right? Is we could, you see those little, like, wand-like things in the middle? There's the idea we could build, like, artificial trees and somehow engineer a way to, like, directly pull carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere.
I think I'm back.
Okay.
She's a good person. So the idea would be these are like scrubbers that would take CO2 out of the atmosphere. There's also the idea that we could burn fuels and collect the CO2 that's being emitted and put that CO2 down underground, carbon capture and storage. The problem with all of these techniques at the moment, there's also iron fertilization, which is the idea that we could dump iron into the ocean and we would fertilize activity in the ocean, and that would make the ocean uptake of carbon dioxide greater and make calcium carbonate, which would sink into the deep ocean. The problem with all these ideas is that we don't actually know how to do them at any scale. So we sort of have the idea of how they would work, but making them work at a big enough scale, having enough throughput to actually make a dent in the carbon emission problem, right now we don't know how to do. On the other axis across the top is the other idea. If the planet's too warm, we can just reduce some of the sunlight coming in the planet. So we could just make the planet reflect a little more solar energy, and that would cool it down. So there's a number of ways that have been suggested of how to do this. My favorite is my own idea that we could just move the planet a little further away from the sun. We do have a problem with exactly how we do that, so we'll just put that aside for the moment. The two kinds of things that have attracted attention are the idea of creating a sort of synthetic particle veil, just like sort of analogous to a volcanic eruption, so that there would be this continuous veil of particles in the stratosphere, which is sort of 15 miles up, and that would reflect solar radiation. We know that works because we've seen it happen after volcanic eruptions. Mm-hmm. The other thing is that we would change the brightness of clouds. The darkest surface on the planet is the ocean. Most of the solar radiation incident on the Earth actually gets absorbed in the ocean. So if we made clouds over the ocean a little bit brighter, they would reflect that radiation away and cool the planet down. The interesting thing on the solar radiation side is we have analogs for how these things work. We think we actually understand them, at least in principle, how this would work. And so we've attracted some attention within the research community about thinking about these problems. Next slide. Okay, so before we move on to the discussion, I want to try and frame this discussion in the sense that there are three questions that we need to think about. And I've posed these as interlocking circles, and I have to start somewhere, and since I'm a science guy, I'll start with science. But the three are really interlocked. And so in the science world, we ask, well, can we do this? So the question is, you know, what are the physical processes, the technical things we need to do? But in addition to that, we need to ask the question of, should we do it? It's not enough in this case to say we can do it. We also need to ask whether this is something that should be done. Should we be trying to manipulate the temperature of the planet? And then there's the governance issue of how do we do it? My wife is here, so I can always use the joke I use with my wife, the how to do it planet problem. It's just like our house in the wintertime, we have a thermostat. So who gets to set the thermostat? You know, somebody turns it up and somebody turns it down, and somebody turns it up and somebody turns it down. My wife says to make sure that I know that you all know she's the one who turns it down because she pays the bills. But this is the question. If we're going to do this, how do we do it, and who gets to decide how we do it? And I also want to point out down on the bottom, there's three boxes that talk about how we would go about thinking about this. One is first doing small-scale experiments that are sort of proof of concept. Do we understand the physics? Then there's an intermediate scale where we do a large-scale experiment to test whether we can actually measure the impacts of what we're doing. And finally, there would be the idea that we would go out and deploy this and actually try and do it. And the questions of ethics and governance and science are different for each one of those boxes. So sometimes when people ask questions about the sort of ethical responsibility, we're talking about way over on this end. Well, what if you're going to deploy this and actually do it? Those aren't necessarily the same ethical questions that would be asked if we were going to start doing an experiment. So keep that in mind when we talk about this, that there's a bunch of dimensions to this problem that sometimes Lauren and I will say, well, let's give a little nuance to that question. What we're really talking about are the dimensions of these problems.
So I just want to clear a couple of things up. One of them, we hear about the 2 degrees Celsius threshold. So I was wondering if either of you could talk a little bit about that and what happens when we reach it and where are we on that scale right now?
Okay. 2 degrees. I can get in a lot of trouble with some people here, just down the street.
That's okay. That's the point.
There's really no threshold at which warming somehow or other becomes, absolutely, totally out of control. Probably a better analogy is to actually think about it in terms of the slippery slope idea. You know, you're walking along and you're walking along. I don't know if you've ever tried to climb a dune with grass on it, and you start up and it's pretty easy at first and you get tired and the slope gets higher and you start sliding back and the progress. So it's a little bit like that. We're not actually going to fall off a cliff. We're not actually going to suddenly have the world end as we know it. But what we're going to see, and that's what Lauren tried to illustrate in the burning embers diagram, is as it gets warmer, the sort of cumulative effects are going to get worse. And I think dramatizing 2 degrees and saying, well, if it gets 2 degrees, that's the end of the world as we know it, is probably wrong.
So when they say it's a point of no return, that's not quite accurate.
Yeah.
Or is it?
Well,
I'm going to try and be short. I have a whole chapter of the book I'm working on this, so... It's hard for philosophers to be short, concise. So I work on risk. I think about risk in the context of climate change and how we can make ethical decisions. And I find the 2-degree goal really problematic for multiple reasons. So first of all, when people talk about the 2-degree goal, the question is, what kind of percentage risk are we willing to allow that we go across 2 degrees? And in general, people, when they talk about 2 degrees, they say, well, we don't want to have more than a 50-50 chance that we're going to go above 2 degrees. But a 50-50 chance that we go above 2 degrees means there's a significant chance that we could end up much higher. Because there's absolutely clear scientific consensus that climate change is happening and that the more greenhouse gases we add to the atmosphere, the warmer it's going to get. The complexity of the system makes it such that we can't, with a really kind of fine-tooth comb, predict exactly what's going to happen with exactly a certain amount of contributions of greenhouse gases. So from an ethical perspective, I think that this is an argument for a real precautionary approach, where we say we shouldn't be willing to risk both kind of our collective well-being and the well-being of all future generations, right, on a 50-50 chance that we're going to stay below this threshold that you all say is morally acceptable. So that's step one. Step two is 2 degrees is not morally acceptable from my perspective. So the kinds of consequences, the kinds of harmful effects we'd see at 2 degrees are significant. Millions and millions of people would be significantly harmful if be affected and die from climate impacts if we hit 2 degrees. The science on that is really clear. So from a moral perspective, I think 2 degrees isn't ambitious enough. Like, I think that we should be trying to say we should have no further warming in the climate system. We already are locked into a pretty significant amount, probably close to 1 degree. We could debate that, the details of that. But the point being, I think we should be very concerned about the amount of climate change that's already locked in the system from a moral perspective. So we should be doing everything we can to mitigate to the greatest extent possible, to prepare ourselves to adapt, right, so to enable adaptation. And it's time to start talking about whether any of these climate engineering strategies should be on the table, given how dire the situation is.
So you're saying... Yes, please, go ahead.
You mentioned the word reversibility, and I want to just point out that what we're doing now is probably not reversible. Once you, and I'll give you one example, if you melt glaciers, right, we're not going to get them back. All right, there's nothing in climate engineering that's going to get you a glacier back. It's going to try and keep the place from not getting much warmer, but it's not going to drive it back to where we were. So we're already in the grip of change that we won't be able to reverse.
So part of the problem is that some of us might not see the immediate effects of that. And I was wondering if you can give a couple of examples. What is happening right now, and let's start with the United States, that should really alarm people, you know, whether it's in the South, around Florida or New Orleans, or actually maybe a little bit locally, the drought that we're having in the state and in California. Is that an effect of climate change, or are there other forces that are contributing to it?
I hope there's a few baseball players here because I'm going to use or baseball fans here because I'm going to use a baseball analogy. How many of you know heard of a guy by the name of Barry Bonds?
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah. How many home runs did he hit this year? How many?
752.
No, in his best year. 70-something, right? Okay. So you're in Pac Bell Park, and he comes up, and he hits one into McCovey Cove. And you go, he hit that because he was on steroids. Well, you don't know that, actually, because he would have hit him into McCovey Cove anyway. The question is, did he ever hit 70 home runs in his life before he started on the juice? And the answer is no. All right? The problem is you can't tell which home run he hit because he was on steroids and which one he didn't. All you know is that overall he hit more than he'd ever hit before because he was on the juice. So if you ask me, is the drought, you know, is the heat wave we're having right now due to global warming, I can't say it is because it's part of a statistical distribution of events which might have happened anyway. All we can do is look at the statistics over time, and we look at the statistics over time, and we go, you know, it's consistently getting warmer. We are consistently seeing hurricanes with more intensity. We are consistently seeing glaciers melting. And so we look at these, and we can tell you statistically that there's something going on, but I can't attribute any one of these events mm-hmm. to climate change. I can't say that's the evil one.
But we can say, right here in the West, we're expecting that over time there's going to be more drought and our mm-hmm. snowpack is going to be more endangered.
Right. And this year, so if I look at this year, I go, well, this is what I expect to see in a warmer climate. 20, 30 years down the road, this is what we will see every year.
This will be more common.
This will be
down
more
the
common.
Road. So this is the kind of thing that will be more common. Another thing that I think we can say pretty unambiguously is we know that sea level is going to keep rising. The question is how fast, and that's a really crucial question because climatic changes, right, when they happen slowly, it gives us a lot more time to adapt and change our way of life, and when they happen quickly, right, that's when we have real problems. Like, how do we suddenly adapt to multiple feet of sea level rise? And, right, new data about kind of the ice sheets in Antarctica, especially West Antarctica, are not good. It looks like they're melting and they're going to continue to melt, but we don't know how fast, and that's a really critical question. But everywhere that has a coastline, right, in the United States is going to face questions of sea level rise. But this brings up another key ethical dimension of climate change. In the United States, we're pretty wealthy overall, and we're going to do things to combat climate change or sea level rise, right? We're going to build seawalls. We're going to figure out how to, like, move infrastructure and protect our freshwater resources. That's just not the case in a lot of countries. Bangladesh, for example, a lot of their freshwater resources, right, are going to be in danger from saltwater intrusion as sea level rise goes up. So I think it's really important to think about climate change from a global perspective and realize that as an ethical issue, right, it shouldn't matter where people live. And part of the injustice here is it's not necessarily the people who are causing the problem who are going to feel the worst effects of it. Yet, unfortunately, just like a kind of horrible coincidence, the worst kinds of climate impacts are generally going to happen in places where people are less wealthy and have less adaptive capacity. Anyways, I'm going on a tangent, but...
No, that's right. Actually, I think we have a question, and then get to something. Go ahead.
Hi. One aspect of all this that I just don't know how anxious I should be has to do with the feedback loops. You know, I read a lot on the internet, and I'm a skeptical person, and I know that there are people who are really way out there on these questions, but with regard to things like methane release or the reversal of the forests from being carbon sinks to carbon generators, these are kind of feedback loops that seem to be coming into play that are kind of terrifying. I mean, if we're triggering this kind of thing the rate of change that we may experience may be much faster than most of the models that we have existing show. Do you have any insight on that?
Scientists actually tend to talk about the things that we understand, and we tend to not want to, or at least the problems that we can sort of wrap our hands around, we don't necessarily have an answer. So something like the methane problem is really complex because we don't understand exactly what, we understand sort of what could happen, but we don't have a very good sense of the risk probability of methane clathrates. The idea that as we melt permafrost, as we melt some of these frozen lakes, that we could release huge amounts of methane, which is a huge greenhouse gas. So I don't know exactly how to answer your question in the sense that, yes, this stuff is possible. It also has large uncertainties around it. And probably the thing that we ought to do is argue that the things we know are bad enough. All right? So what you're talking about is just going to make it worse. So let's deal with what we already know. And I'm more concerned about that. People who say, well, none of that's going to happen, you guys are all wrong, than saying, well, there are other things out there that might make it worse. But I think it's worthwhile for us to understand that when we talk about 2 degrees of change or 4 degrees of change, we're actually talking about a distribution. And like any probability, there's always some probability that it'll be worse than we're saying, you know, 50% plus or minus 20. Well, that means it might be 30, but it might be 70, right? We say 2 degrees plus or minus 2. Oh, well, maybe it'll be 4. And we tend to downplay that, and that's not a good thing.
So you found a place where we disagree, so this is great, because sometimes, we do, actually. Okay. We disagree here. So I think you hit on a really important issue, and it's exactly kind of what the focus of all my work is. I lost track of where you just went. There you went. So from an ethical perspective, I think that those kinds of possibilities are of critical importance. So the very possibility that these things could happen and that we can't quantify the likelihood of them happening, right, the probability that they're going to happen in the next 50, 100,000 years, that's the very reason we should be concerned, because we do know they're possible, right? We have a scientific explanation for why they're possible and what the kind of mechanisms look like. So these are the kind of things that I worry about as a philosopher all the time, because I think that justifies an even more aggressive approach to climate policy than... this is why I'm worried about 2 degrees, right? I'm worried that we're too focused on kind of the best case scenario and we're not focused enough about the worst case scenario. So I'm going to give you a quick example, if you don't mind. Please. So in this book I've been talking about, I've been working on it for like 6 years, which is a really long time, but it turns out it takes really hard to write a book. And when I started the book, my paradigm example of a really bad, a catastrophic threat of harm about which there was what I'm calling genuine uncertainty, right? We knew it was possible, but we didn't know whether or not what the likelihoods are. The scientists weren't willing to put any probability figures on it. So the example I used was the melting of the West Antarctic ice sheet. And the reason I chose that example is scientists can very precisely calculate how much water is locked up in the West Antarctic ice sheet. So we know that there would be multiple between 2 and 5 meters of sea level rise if the whole thing melted, right? Meters, that's like unfathomable, right? And so I used it throughout the book as this narrative of this like uncertain threat of harm. So in the last year, maybe year and a half, several studies have come out that have shown it looks like the West Antarctic ice sheet is starting to melt, and there's a bunch of feedback loops that are making that look pretty inevitable, right? There's not 100% certainty there, but there's multiple studies confirming that we're on the path towards that. However, scientists are still unwilling to quantify how fast that's going to happen, and that's critical, right? It could happen over the course of thousands of years, in which case it won't be, I mean, it will still be harmful, but we can kind of deal with it slowly as it happens. But we don't know, right? So a couple years ago, we couldn't fathom that this was gonna, that we had crossed this threshold. And it turns out maybe we already have. And maybe for reasons that don't just try to anthropogenic climate change, right? Maybe there's other causal factors at work. We don't know all the causation. And Tom, you can correct me if I say anything scientifically horribly erroneous, which would be important because this is going in the book, which is almost done. But so the point being, right, I've had to rewrite the book and change the narrative of this being a prime example of why this matters, right? Because we thought this was a distant possibility, and all of a sudden, 5 years later, it looks like a very real possibility, like a threshold that we've already crossed. So I think that's an argument for taking really aggressive policy or steps to mitigate climate change as much as possible, to avoid crossing any further thresholds, because I'm really worried about those thresholds. Because I don't think it matters from a moral perspective whether someone lives now 100 years, 1,000 years, 200 years, I think, or 2,000 years, we should care about humans whenever they live and make sure that we're going to, right, continue to support the kinds of conditions that make human existence a nice thing.
By the way, the working title, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, if it's still, A Climate of Risk, Precautionary Principles, Catastrophes, and Climate Change. Is that still
and
the...
it's really close.
Okay, yeah. That's still the title. So A Climate of Risk. So look for it hopefully very soon.
On the bestseller list.
Yes, exactly.
You could help.
if it reaches Costco, you know you've made it. So I have a two-part question. So the first is I've heard that everything we have done so far, from energy standards in cars to big agreements like the Kyoto Protocol to, you know, the light bulbs that everybody's encouraging people to take, and I think there was actually legislation to that we. You know, the incandescent light bulbs are gone, but I've heard they're coming back. But anyway, hopefully not. But I've heard that all of this together combined is not making a dent into stopping or at least slowing down the effects of climate change. So that's my first part of the question. Is that true? Is everything we've done so far not doing anything?
No.
It is? It is making a difference?
Go ahead. I'll let you go first.
I think every molecule of carbon dioxide that we keep out of the atmosphere is making a difference. Maybe it's, right, a very small difference, but the more that's up there, right, the worse it is. So it depends on how you look at the problem, right? From a big picture perspective, have we done enough to, like, really make a dent in how fast things are changing? Mm-hmm. Not really, but that's in part because of a whole bunch of other complex factors, right? Population growth is still rising. More and more people are living more and more carbon-intensive lifestyles. So, yes, it's making a dent, but it's not making a big enough dent because more and more of the world is living in the way that's making the problem worse. So,
okay.
Scientist, what do you think?
I think the world is complicated, and this is a complicated subject. So let's start with the first thing Lauren said about every CO2 molecule. Every CO2 molecule that we put in the atmosphere is basically going to be there in a couple hundred years.
And some of them
some of them will be there for thousands of years. All right? CO2 has a very long lifetime. So every time you say, okay, I didn't do something and so I didn't put CO2 into the atmosphere, that's a good thing. Now, so start with that perspective, that any molecule that didn't go in the atmosphere is a good thing. So we look at what's happened in the United States over the last few years, and the average carbon emission per person, which is probably the best way to think about this problem. So your carbon footprint, how much carbon are you responsible per year? And I'm not going to try and assign values to each one of you. We'll just take the canonical value for the United States as a whole and divide by population. The United States has the largest per person carbon footprint in the world. We have two close competitors, Australia and Canada. All right? And I always like to ask my students, how come, you know, what do the three countries have in common that gives us a big carbon footprint? And it's not because we speak English, because I've been to Australia. It has to do with the fact that we have low population density and we spend a lot of our carbon footprint on transportation. All right? So if you look at carbon production over the last carbon dioxide concentrations over the last 10 or 15 years, we have actually been going up faster than we were before. Every year, the amount of carbon dioxide going into the atmosphere is more than the year before. And you say, well, the United States has actually reduced its carbon footprint because we've gone to using natural gas instead of coal because of fracking. Now, we can argue about whether fracking is good or bad, but I can tell you that natural gas is a lot better than coal in terms of CO2 production. But at the same time, China has ramped up its industrialization at a rate that nobody thought was possible 15 years ago, and therefore the CO2 emissions of the world as a whole have increased. So what's the solution to this? The solution, and if you look at the Kyoto Protocol, there's lots of nice agreements that got signed, but people didn't actually manage to meet the Kyoto Protocol. So the answer is, yeah, we've done a little bit. Yeah, we ought to be doing a lot more, and there's a lot more that we could be doing. And yes, we got a problem here because we have nations that want to industrialize, that where people want to have access to more and cheaper energy, and we're not figuring out a solution to that that doesn't involve burning fossil fuels. There are solutions. We're just not – we don't have the will to do something about it.
Yeah, I just want to add the ethics side of that, which is I think you're not denying, but I'm just wanting to make it really explicit that one of the key kind of issues here is it seems really unfair to say to those people who aren't living this right wonderful developed life, having beers in an air-conditioned bar on a Tuesday evening after work, right, to say, oh, you don't get to develop because we're living this way and we're using up the world's carbon budget, so you just stay where you are, right? So that seems really unfair, right? The reason we've gotten to this place is because industrialization had all these side effects that no one intended, right? No one knew when we started the Industrial Revolution that this is where we were going to end up. But from an equity perspective, there's this question of, well, how do we find a just solution to this problem, right, that allows people to develop but that also reduces our overall greenhouse gas emissions, right? Some easy but not easy solutions are, well, let's just share technology around the world, right? There's a lot of technology we have that if we actually implemented it quickly could significantly not only reduce the amount of greenhouse gases being emitted into the atmosphere but could also increase equity around the planet. So, for example, right, in places where people are burning wood and coal and other things in their homes to cook their food and heat their houses, if we provide, you know, just made technology available so they could be doing all of those things with renewable energy, we would, right, increase justice, right, equity around the world while also reducing greenhouse gas emissions. So anyways, yeah.
Yeah, so great point, because you made a point about environmental justice, and this, I think, kind of fits into there. India has about 400 million people that don't have electricity. And if India decides we want to give electricity, I mean, it wouldn't be ethical for us to say, no, you can't. So what is that? What is the ethical solution? Is it just investing in renewable sources of energy to at least allow India to give electricity to these folks? Or I don't know. I'm looking for a solution here.
I hate when I'm asked what the ethical solution is. One of my students is here, so she'll understand what I'm saying. Because it's much more complicated than that, right? There's never just, like, the solution. I wish it was so easy. but I can tell you what the solution isn't, right? It isn't, say, you don't get to do that, but we're going to keep living the way that we do. This is where
so
it's really
are you
going
to convince Americans to not live the way we do right now? I mean, is that even possible?
I think that maybe Tom can speak to this, but I think there's a lot of technologies out there that if we really chose to make a change in how we generate energy, we could make a dent.
Of course it's possible. We don't have to live the way that we live right now. We could be making a lot more use of renewable energy technologies. Mm-hmm. We could replace our dependence on fossil fuels in many cases with renewable systems. So what we need to do is say, yeah, we're going to trade off part of our carbon footprint with technology, with different approaches to solving problems, and we're going to try and ship those same technology to the developing countries, but we're also going to recognize that they get to invest in some kinds of fossil fuel technology because we already have them, and we can't say, unless we're willing to say, we're not going to have anything to do with them. If you want a perfect example of what not to do, how many of you paid any attention to the transportation policy that was passed for this state last night? All right? In the middle of this wonderful bill, there's a poison pill that says what? What's going to happen if we aren't careful? We're going to end up saying that we're going to reduce carbon. So one of the things we could do is change the amount of fuel, change the fuel efficiency standards on automobiles. This state just passed a law that says if we do that, we take transportation money and invest it in roads and take it away from public transit. I mean, this is like...
Yeah, it takes
really
$700 million out of the transportation budget and puts it into roads if we enact anything to reduce carbon emissions
right.
in the state. Yeah,
yeah. I mean, this is exactly the wrong message to send. It's exactly the wrong thing to do. So, you know, we have plenty of examples of things not to do. We can give you examples of things to do.
So this is great. This is a really good point. And I'll get to your question in just one second. I just do want to make a point about why is that poison pill even there? I mean, does it all have to do with money? Is that what it always comes down to? Is somebody is making profit off of something, and that's why these poisons are there?
I'm just a poor scientist, dude.
I'm just a poor artist. This is actually a great point to make, a really quick point about interdisciplinarity that I think I want to make. So I think it's awesome Tom wants to talk to me, right? I'm the philosopher, and there's a scientist who really wants to have a conversation with me. Not only that, right, Tom and his colleagues a few years ago, when they started to do this research on marine cloud brightening, said, oh my goodness, there's like major ethical issues here. Maybe we should go like talk to some philosophers and get them in from the beginning, right? So they came down to the philosophy department and knocked on our doors and said, we don't know even how to think about this research, right? This is something that we realize we should be talking to you about, and we should be kind of collaborating on how we think about, right, doing even the research about the kinds of options that are available. So that's a way of punting on this question, which is to say, there are a lot of people who can weigh in on that, and I'm going to talk to them and talk to them about the ethical issues, and Tom needs to talk to them about the scientific issues. But you would need a policy person on this stage who, especially someone who knows something in more depth than I do about local politics.
Excellent. We have a question.
Well, I was, you're talking about you haven't gotten to talking about geoengineering.
True.
Bring us there.
But you are on the borderline of talking about social engineering, it seemed to me. And geoengineering potentially affects lots of people who didn't ask for it. Why not just do social engineering and affect a bunch of people who didn't ask for it? Or bioengineering. Maybe we should be growing GMOs that suck more carbon dioxide out. I don't know if that's
for a second
good thing.
I thought you were going to say we should engineer people, so I'm glad you didn't go.
Well, or engineer people to suck carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. Would that be any greater of a consequence than some of the geoengineering strategies?
I think your question about social engineering is really interesting, and I would say that we've been social engineering for a long time in odd sorts of ways. I can remember a conversation I had a long time ago with a young friend of mine. We were both young then, I might say, who's a tax lawyer. And we were discussing whether or not the tax code should be used to essentially do social engineering. We pass certain things in a tax code that encourage certain kinds of behavior. All right? So the question that I think goes back to the answer that goes back to the earlier question is, how do we come to an agreement as a society as to what kind of behaviors are socially acceptable and that we want to encourage? The one that I just quoted of, you know, putting this poison pill in the middle of the bill strikes me as a kind of behavior that we certainly don't want to encourage. As far as the question of climate engineering or geoengineering, one of the real issues that we talk about between that side of the fence and my side of the fence is, what do we mean by engaging the public in the process? If you do sort of bioethics and you talk about, well, if you're going to do a trial and you're going to give people a drug or whatever, you talk about informed consent. We have to explain to you what the issues are and what the side effects might be, and you have to decide whether or not you want to participate. So suppose we start trying to engineer the climate. How do we get informed consent from the planet? All right? How do we get informed consent from everybody in the planet? And what does that mean? And how do we get informed consent from people not yet born? All right? So this issue can tie you into little knots as far as the discussion between the ethics and ethicists and the scientists. So if I go back to that little three boxes that I had up there, the experiment side doesn't quite get us into that mess of the deployment side. We can still do the experiment side and say, look, there's not harmful effects on the planet as a whole. I don't need informed consent from everybody. If we start going to the other end and say we're actually going to deploy this geoengineering, climate engineering technology, and we're going to try and control climate, then we've got a lot stickier issue, and that's where this governance thing shows up. Who gets to be in charge? Who gets to decide?
So, Tom, you went exactly where I wanted this time, which I didn't think you were going to at the beginning. So I'm going to I wanted to use your question, too, to bring us back to geoengineering, because that's what we're supposed to be talking about today. So as an ethicist, my kind of gut reaction is to be much more concerned about solar radiation management than carbon dioxide removal. And here's why. It's exactly what Tom was just talking about, right? There's even, no way in even conceptually to imagine how we could think about a governance structure that would genuinely incorporate, right, the voices of all of those affected. Because when we start to engineer the climate at this grand scale with solar radiation management, we're affecting everyone on it and the future climate for all people, right? So whereas the challenge of getting everyone to the table on a global climate agreement seems extraordinarily daunting, when you bring into account the timescales involved and think about this as an intergenerational problem, which I really think dominates the whole problem, because as Tom alluded to earlier, right, what we're doing is going to have implications for thousands and thousands of years. The ethical challenge there is extraordinarily daunting. So that makes, right, carbon dioxide removal seem less daunting, because it's like, okay, we're just kind of pulling carbon dioxide out. On the other hand, if carbon dioxide removal was effective, right, insofar as it actually affected the global climate, we actually face the same ethical issues there, because in both cases we're having, right, influences on the entire planet. So there's really massive ethical questions, and I'm a little bit more nervous about geoengineering research than Tom is, in part because I think if we realize that there's conceptually no available solutions at the governance end, at the deployment end, right, it might be irresponsible to start doing the research if we know that there's kind of no trajectory that's going to lead to a scenario in which we could deploy this in an ethical way. That said, I think it's worth at least starting to ask the questions and doing the kind of research, right, computer modeling, right, starting to talk about it so we can have a better sense of what we're talking about. Because right now, right, it's all kind of high-in-the-sky ideas, and we need to better understand what it is we're talking about before we can have a really informed conversation about the ethics and governance, which is Tom. So that brings me back to closer to Tom again.
So we got another question?
Yes. 2 years ago when we were in Iceland, people were talking about an ice age and talked to us a great deal about the fact that they're expecting a volcanic reaction as severe as one that happened, I think it was about 1700 or maybe 700 or so years ago, which killed many people and which left an ice age in Europe, northern England particularly, and through Iceland. And so when we talk about global change, how is that going to impact this overall process? And is that sort of a geoengineering problem that the Earth is going to visit on us, whether we like it or not?
How long ago was it that you were in Iceland?
2 years ago.
2 years ago, and they were talking about ice ages?
Ice age.
I hope they were talking about past ice ages and not...
No, they're talking. They're looking forward to a huge volcanic,
okay.
And they were, the newspapers,
okay.
Everybody we talked to.
I got a course for you to come on over to the university and take. If you look at, so the first thing that you really need to think about is timescales. All right? And this is a hard thing. I teach a class on climate and climate change at the university, and I struggle to get this concept across to my students, and I have lots more time with them. So I'll try and do it. But you really need to think about what we're talking about in terms of the time that it takes for things to happen. So when we talk about geologic time scales, we're talking typically tens of thousands of years. So if I look, when was the last glacial maximum? The last glacial maximum was 20,000 years ago. All right? We've warmed up something like 5 or 6 degrees centigrade since that glacial maximum. We are talking about warming up 4 to 5 degrees in the next 100 years. All right? So one of the issues here is when people talk about past ice ages and the rhythm of ice ages, we know that the ice ages have come roughly 100,000 years apart for the last 800,000 years. How do we know that? We dig ice cores. I say we. I don't do any of this. It's too hard to work. You have to go to places like Greenland. You have to dig a hole, you know, drill holes and look at the, you know, that's like real work. So, but we know that these things come about every 100,000 years. So right now we're in the interglacial. All right, it's nice and warm. We've been in the interglacial for 10,000 years. We've had we call the Holocene climate. It's been really nice for 10,000 years. So if you look at this in some big picture, you say, oh, well, we could be ready for another ice age, all right, because we've been in this interglacial for about 10,000 years. It takes us 80,000 years to go from the glacial interglacial to the glacial max. So that time scale is huge. Volcanic activity is not going to make that happen in 100 years. we are pumping CO2 into the atmosphere at a rate that's changing our climate on the timescale of a year, on 10 years and 100 years. This is completely different than what we've experienced in the past. If we look at the same 800,000 years and we say, what's the carbon dioxide concentration? The highest carbon dioxide concentration in the last 800,000 years is about 300 part per million. So that's if I got a box with a million molecules in, 300 of them are CO2. We're now at 400 and counting. And we've gone from 300 to 400 in 100 plus years. All right? We are driving climate change at a rate that we have not seen in the last 800,000 years. And when people talk about, well, we could be entering another ice age, only if you want to think about this on a timescale of 80,000 years. If you want to think about it on a timescale of 100 years, don't even think it. We're not even in the, it's not even in the ball game, okay? And in fact, because we're jacking up the CO2, the odds are, if we look at the way climate behaves, we will never see another ice age in the next, you know, couple hundred thousand years.
So
I can't say, I won't be around to check it out, so it's easy to make that forecast.
I'm going to just add one kind of maybe layer that might help thinking about the ethics of this. I think it really matters that when we're talking about climate change, we're talking about anthropogenic climate change, and what that means is it's human-caused or human-driven climate change. So we know we're doing these things which are going to have effects on really geologically really short timescales, right? So yes, we should be dealing with those. Should we be trying to anticipate, right, natural disasters that might happen? Absolutely, but that's a very different kind of story, right? And if, right, you know, something unexpected happens, like, okay, we'll deal with that. But that shouldn't change the fact that we should be dealing with what we know we are causing, right? Absolutely, we should be thinking about natural risks. And I think Tom is absolutely right in everything he just said about, right, it's actually a pretty low natural risk of us going into an ice age, especially given what we're doing. But this kind of the anthropogenic nature of climate change is key to understanding, right, why it's so imperative that we do something about it from a moral perspective.
Go ahead. Question?
Hi. So I feel like actually addressing this problem at a global scale is going to cost just a ton of money, an unfathomable amount of money. And if we're going to invest that money in it, I think that we should invest it in the right thing. It's very easy to say that we're going to do something about it now without fully understanding the problem. And then we can lead to something like what this gentleman said earlier about like a methane release that wouldn't be covered by the any change that we do now to remove carbon. So, and then, you know, people get fed up with spending a lot of money on things that go nowhere. And so what it seems to me that anything we do is really just kind of a Band-Aid on the fundamental problem. And that is we can reduce our carbon footprint, but ultimately there's still going to be population growth, and as a result of that, people in general are just going to use more and more energy, and you know, we'll have more of a population, but we're still kind of, you know, doomed in the end. So to me, it seems like the best possible use of money to really address this problem is to do something like space exploration, you know, getting humans in space, we colonizing other worlds. So what do you think about just accepting the fact that this will happen regardless of what we're going to do about it and just spending the money that we would have spent on geoengineering efforts into things like getting humans into space?
So that's a great question, and let's take it from two
sides.
Can you
stop just a minute? Is there somebody sitting in the back by that window that could maybe turn those blinds a little bit so that Lauren and I might possibly be able to see something?
And open our eyes.
Yeah.
That'd be lovely. Thank you.
Oh, look at that. That's
great. Yay.
You have faces.
Solar radiation management right there.
Nothing like solar radiation dimming to...
So a great question. So first of all, I want to take this question from two sides, ethics and science. First of all, the science, are we anywhere near colonizing another planet?
No.
And we won't be for hundreds, thousands of years? I mean, we don't even have pictures of Pluto for it yet. So.
You know, I once upon a time I was a NASA scientist. Once upon a time we actually had, you know, sort of space exploration programs. We don't really anymore. we have decided this is not something that we're really interested in. So, we had a president, not the current one, but the one before, who made a big deal of how we were going to have this initiative to put man on, people on Mars. Well, if you happen, I have a statement I use in a number of occasions that budgets are actually moral documents. All right, the way you spend your money says something about your ethics. And it's okay if you get up and say we're gonna colonize space, we're gonna send somebody to Mars, but if you don't increase the budget for it, you can't be very serious about it. All right, that's kind of where we are with this discussion. There was no increase in that budget for space exploration, so nobody was really serious about it. We are not close to it, and even if we started a crash program now, we're still talking about 50 years before we could actually put somebody on Mars, and that's, well, I'm probably exaggerating there, but if you think about a colony, I think 50 years is probably, and we've got billions of people on Earth, so are we going to just say, all right, let's invest our money in colonizing some other planet, and those of you on Earth who don't make it, too bad. I don't find that a very compelling argument, and I don't think we're very close to being doing it.
So from the ethics part of it, do we give up on Earth?
No. And I have so much to say on this, and I wouldn't do this in class, but I'm going to do it here. My short answer is no, to everything you just said. And I want to tell you why, right? I want to give you a reason to be an optimist. I've given talks on, right, why, how am I so optimistic in the face of all this? I get asked that all the time, right? I'm this very optimistic person, and I deal with really horrible stuff all the time. So, trying to think about where I even start. There's, like, my head is overwhelmed. So, I don't think things are nearly as dire as you think in terms of how expensive it is to act. So, right. I wish there's a graduate student in my department who's going to come tonight, and he's not here, and he has all the numbers in his head, and I wish he was here so he could share them with me. But there are tons of economic studies that show all of the things that we should do to address climate change that we already know, like not even talking about climate engineering, would be good for us, right? Like, we can do things that wouldn't be expensive. They're only expensive if you're unwilling to take a big picture perspective and think about even 100 years, right? They're expensive if you think about 1 year or 5 years. But if you start to think about 25 or 50 or 100, goodness forgive it, like 1,000, they're not expensive at all, right? They're quite cheap. So the things that we could do, you're worried about overpopulation? Let's give access for education and birth control to every woman on this planet, and we will have like a major way of addressing climate change because we're going to significantly reduce population growth. All you have to do is give women education and access to birth control, and you significantly reduce population growth, right? Cheap, easy from a big picture perspective. Billions of people are expensive, right? So if we can stop right that curve right now and not hit 10 billion, which would be lovely if we could just stay at 7, which is already unfathomable, awesome, right? And by the way, we'll also have increased social equity around the entire planet because women will be educated and will be able to participate in our planet. Okay, sorry, little rant. I have like 17 more in my head.
Can I interrupt that rant for a moment?
Yes.
Maybe I'll slow her down. The whole issue of population is important, but is probably not as important as people make it out to be. One extra person in the... Remember this per capita thing, all right? One extra person in the United States in terms of carbon footprint is hundreds of Bangladeshis, all right? So when you say population control, it's all about controlling population in India. No, it's not, all right? It's not about controlling population in Bangladesh. It's about starting with our own carbon footprint and reducing it down to something that makes sense instead of being out here on the far extreme. And we have technologies, we have approaches to do it. It's not going to cost us an ungodly amount of money. We spend an ungodly amount of money every year. It's on something called the military. All right? If we took even a fraction of that and devoted it to thinking about how we could create different technologies and different energy production, we wouldn't be in the situation we're in.
Yeah. So I took an easy shot, like at a kind of low-hanging fruit, an argument I could make that could rile me and all of you up. But the point is that there's all kinds of arguments across the board, right? In investing in greener technologies, if we stop emitting so much coal, we can reduce asthma rates, reduce air pollution, right? There's all these co-benefits to all almost all of the kind of greener technologies we're talking about have massive co-benefits, both from an economic perspective, but also from social justice perspective. So they're only expensive if you look at them from a certain kind of narrow framework. So I just want to use this as an aside. Even within the economics community, there's massive disputes about how we should think about climate change. This is another chapter of my book, right? So there's some economists who get this, who get the kind of arguments I'm making, that like there are kind of ethical considerations in how we even run the numbers and think about the expenses of climate change. And if you take a very narrow kind of traditional approach to economic analysis, for example, you use a high traditional discount rate, things look expensive. But if you get rid of that high discount rate because you're thinking about equity and long timescales, you're thinking about the possibility of the West Antarctic ice sheet melting. So when you use a high discount rate, the worst scenarios actually drop out scientifically, which means they drop out of your economic models. I know I'm getting into detail for some people, but I really want to get through to this guy. So it matters, right, how we frame the questions, like, and that we incorporate ethics from the very beginning. But it's not going to be expensive to deal with climate change. It's an issue of will. It's an issue of governance. It's an issue of choosing to do these things that are going to change. It's going to cause change, right? And people don't like change because some people are going to get richer and some people are going to get poorer. And the people who are rich right now who are going to get poorer are going to fight against that really hard, right? So anyways, I don't know if I touched on everything, but I want to come back to the geoengineering thread. Geoengineering is not our answer. So geoengineering, and you can back me up on this. I mean, alone. You agree with me on this. It doesn't
So we're not at a point where we have to do this or else we're done for?
Well, can I get there in just a second? Yeah. Can I just say one thing? I know I'm on a ranting roll.
yes.
But so when we talk about solar radiation management, right, we're talking about reflecting solar radiation back into space. It's not going to bring us back to our baseline, right? Intuitively, it seems like, oh, we can just go back to where we started with this technology. But it doesn't. It moves us from state A. Instead of going to B, it brings us to state C. So maybe state C is the same temperature as state A, but it's not the same climate as state A. So there's going to be winners and losers, right? Climate changing is causing precipitation changes around the globe. Geoengineering is also going to cause precipitation changes, which means some people are going to experience droughts who actually would have been in a great climate if we'd had climate change, and other people are going to have a lot of water who would have been in a drought with climate change. So it's a smaller number of people who are harmed, but there's still going to be people who are harmed and benefited from this. And right, it's not going to solve things like ocean acidification. So it doesn't solve all of our problems. It cannot be the only solution. Even the most radical climate scientists who are arguing for this think we need an aggressive mitigation approach, and it's the Band-Aid. Geoengineering is the Band-Aid that gets us over the hurdle for the next 100 years to a place where we can not need it at all.
Great. Okay. So let's take a question. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm glad you ended on where you did, because that leads perfectly into my question about those three categories of solutions, the mitigation, engineering, and adaptation. And I have maybe a hunch where you might think we should be the least optimistic about changes actually being made, because obviously we have a lot of solutions that we think would work if people were willing to do it or were willing to put the money on it. But I'm wondering which category you think we should be the most optimistic about, and if it's not the mitigation element, maybe ethically, where does that leave us as far as our individual responsibility goes?
What do you mean by optimistic about?
So not optimistic in the solutions available, but in people actually willing to change or make a change in their behavior or change policy. So I guess how optimistic should we be that people are actually going to fund geoengineering efforts? Or how optimistic should we be that we're actually find a way to leave the planet? Or how optimistic should we be that people are actually going to lower their individual carbon footprint? Which of those?
So there's a statement attributed to Winston Churchill, who said Americans can be counted on to do the right thing after they've done everything else, or something to that effect. So I'm optimistic that we will adapt, because we are adaptable people. So it's not what I would choose as the right answer, but I'm optimistic that we will figure out how to adapt. And I think Lauren alluded to it earlier, the thing that really bothers me is that the nations that are able to adapt are the nations that are already technologically, financially well off, all right? Because we will have the resources and the know-how. So we're sort of doubling down on the poor countries. You're in Bangladesh, you don't have anything to start with, and oh yeah, by the way, when sea level rises, a third of your country will disappear. All right. So on one hand, I'm optimistic about adaptation, but I think you can see the ethical issues that you're going to raise. I can point you at islands in the Pacific that the highest point on the island is 10 feet. So if we talk about a meter of sea level rise, and we get 3 feet of sea level rise, because their land sort of looks like a triangle, half of their land area goes away. They're not survivable anymore. So what are we going to do? Are we going to say, oh, well, you all come on over and settle in our country. We'll give you, we'll give you nice farmland and whatever, and you can live here, right? We all believe that we'll have an open immigration policy, right? Okay, so I think this issue of adaptation is really what we can count on happening, but I don't think it's the right answer. I think that if you want the ethically right answer, the ethically right answer is the mitigation piece. We should be trying to stop what we're doing. We know, do you have children?
No.
Okay, we do. When they were doing bad things, you would say, stop doing that. That's not acceptable behavior. The United States should be accepting the fact that we are behaving in a bad manner.
Well, I have students, and I try to impart the, significance of the problem, but when we talk about all the evidence and how terrible it's looking and how we've passed these thresholds and maybe we can't reverse it, how do I get them to care?
I understand. And so let's take the middle road. When we talk about climate engineering, once again, we agree, climate engineering can only be seen as a temporary stopgap. And I'm exploring with one of my graduate students right now a sort of scenario-based approach to this, saying, how can you think about using geoengineering or climate engineering in a way that tries to work against the worst aspects of climate change, but only in the context of us actually getting serious about removing CO2. So in terms of these strategies, we can be optimistic about adaptation. It will occur. We can look at mitigation and say, this is really what we should be doing, and let's view climate engineering as a way somewhere in the middle to try and ratchet down the worst effects of climate change, maybe while we're on the way to some combination of mitigating and adapting.
I'd say even more simply, we should be doing all of the above, right? The answer is all of the above, right? A huge focus should be both on mitigation and adaptation. There's a lot of climate change that's locked in the system. We need to deal with that, but we also need to, right, cut it off. Let's not have any more than we have to. But I think it's time to at least be putting energy into looking into things in that middle box, right, that climate engineering box. So it's an all and answer at this point, right? Okay, yes, right, it's scary what's happening, so let's enable adaptation around the world and not just let this be another driver of social injustice, right, where the rich get to adapt and the poor don't. Let's work on helping everyone be ready to adapt, but let's also mitigate and let's also explore other options that could be our Band-Aid.
Thanks. So, did you have a question, ma'am? Go right ahead. Yes, go right ahead.
Is it connected? Okay. Several years ago in 2011, the British Royal Society asked for papers on solar radiation management. And I asked some colleagues of mine if they were interested in writing such a paper, and no one else expressed interest in my immediate circle, so I did. And the name of the paper was Solar Radiation Management, Sunblock on the Light of Truth. The paper began with the assertion that science is the discipline that seeks the truth of nature, and philosophy the discipline that seeks the nature of truth. And if truth in either of these disciplines is disregarded, the world is in great danger. The paper went on to discuss how the Royal Society, as this discussion, is seeking to frame solar radiation management as something that's conceptual and considered. However, if one will look up from one's iPad into the skies and begin doing their own research, you will see that there has been a major worldwide geoengineering program since the mid-1990s. And this can be established, and it has caused massive problems, including most likely the drought in California. There is a great deal of evidence, and there is all actual betting on this in the stock markets on weather derivatives, where the weather, it's known very well that the weather can be controlled, and there's a small minority who are making huge amounts of money on this, with this type of control. This is real because I just saw the report from a stock brokerage this afternoon on the very thing. So I would consider it a very good idea if people would begin to research this for themselves and not take other people's word for it, that our government and military may be involved in their black budget projects in some very dark things that need to be actually discussed, not conceptually, and ethics needs to be applied, because certainly if this is happening, and I can assure you it is, if you will look up in the skies, you will see it empirically, we are not being consulted as to this program. And there needs to be massive public debate beyond this sort of debate where we're just talking about it conceptually. We need to start talking about holding people accountable for doing this without our consent. And I also wish to say that in all that has been discussed from my research this evening, that finding the massively suppressed technologies that, again, certain parties in our government and military have been massively suppressing, including the electric car is a much more obvious example to everyone, and if you haven't seen the movie, I suggest you do. Also, free zero-point energy, which was rediscovered by Nikola Tesla and other great scientists from the mid-19th century to the early 20th century, and that we haven't seen much of because there's massive media suppression of it, as there is with this global geoengineering program. So I urge you to web search this and start researching this for yourself, and don't take everybody's word for it, but begin to use your own discernment.
Great. Thank you. Thank you very much. That's true. Everybody, I do believe, that should do a lot of research into this and not just take somebody's word for it. Otherwise, you know, you look at the fee and you take what they have to say, and we're a whole lot of trouble. So I do want to ask really one question about how much do we know about the consequences of some of the projects that are being proposed regarding geoengineering? I mean, we can narrow it down if you want a little bit more, maybe the brightening of marine clouds.
Consequences.
The consequences on ecosystems, maybe.
All right.
Whether ocean acidification or something else, negative consequences.
Climate is a complicated beast, right? I can tell you that from lots of years of looking at lots and lots of things related to climate. I'm not going to sit here and tell you that if we run our model and we double CO2 that we're going to get exactly, if we take a global climate model and we double CO2, I'm not going to tell you we know exactly what's going to happen. Likewise, if I say, oh, I'm going to reduce solar radiation at the same time I'm increasing CO2, that I can tell you exactly what's going to happen. So I can only speak in generalities. If you want more detail, I can provide, references of more detail. Basically, what we're looking at is the idea that you're trying to warm the planet in one direction and you're trying to cool the planet in another direction. Mm-hmm. So overall, you can think about getting the temperature approximately the same, or you can think about getting the total precipitation about the same, but you can't guarantee that you're going to get exactly the same weather patterns and exactly the same distribution. So just as a for instance, I could say, well, if I increase the CO2 concentrations a lot, what we see in the models is we tend to dry out even drier the dry belts of the world. So think about sub-Saharan Africa, the Sahel. We would make that much drier, and we already see indications of that. Now, if we look at some kinds of climate engineering solutions, it suggests that we can stop that. But at the same time, we might affect the monsoons in India. All right? So here's a trade-off. Do we have a really nasty impact in sub-Saharan Africa, or do we have a lesser impact in India? All right? And right now, I can't say with 100% confidence that I can tell you which one's going to happen. All I can tell you is that the climate differences will be more benign if we reduce the solar radiation while we're increasing CO2 than if we just allow CO2 to increase. That's sort of the motivation to think about this problem is, can we make this climate change less benign? But one of the things that's really spooky about this is, if I started some sort of climate engineering program and I stopped doing it, in about a decade, the climate will go back to where it would have been anyway. So there's an ethical issue here about us starting one of these climate solar radiation management programs and then saying to our children and our children's children that, by the way, you got to keep this going, because if you stop, it's going to get really bad, all right, unless we're taking the CO2 down at the same time. Yeah. So that's a long-winded answer to a really hard question.
I know.
Let me add a little. So Tom was mostly talking about the solar radiation management end of the spectrum, and I agree with everything he just said. I've done some work looking at detail and the range of carbon dioxide removal strategies. And basically, the ones that have the potential to have less of an impact tend to be more understood and safer in terms of consequences than the ones that would potentially have more of an impact. So reforestation, right? But even that comes with risk, because it's like, how are we reforesting? Is it actually going to stay there for long periods of time? There's this idea of biochar. Let's like burn a bunch of stuff, turn it into charcoal, and then bury it. That looks relatively safe, but you can't really do that on a big enough scale to make a huge difference. So in a paper I published with a whole bunch of different kinds of scholars, there was even a historian, some scientists, some social scientists, a sociologist, we kind of, you know, ranked these all. And solar radiation management, because of its scale, really was the ultimate driving reason, looks like the kind of most risky from many different dimensions. Really small scale carbon dioxide removal projects look a lot safer, but they're not going to make as much of a difference. So, but in all cases, we don't really know at this point. And that's part of the issue of why we should probably do some at least initial research to think about, right, is this something we want to pursue further, right? We're really in the first box if we went to Tom's diagram. And I think we're both supportive of at least pushing that box, the work in that box a little further.
Mm-hmm.
I'm more nervous about it than Tom, but
I'm very supportive of pushing that box.
I know, and I'm like hesitantly maybe a little bit supportive.
So I think we're going to have time for one more question. So you're standing there. Go right ahead, sir.
You can do two.
We can do two.
Thank you. So I agree that the adaptation issue seems more promising than the geoengineering approach. But I wonder if we could say a little bit more about the likelihood that adaptation is going to work, given that people don't seem to be too motivated by appeals to conscience. So I'm sure, Lauren, you're familiar with Garrett Hardin's argument from years ago that, look, appeals to conscience just aren't going to work, right? If we expect people to not procreate, and if we expect people to, you know, reduce their carbon footprint by their own free will, they're not going to do that. So, I mean, these common sense approaches that we talk about all the time aren't being enforced, and I'm wondering, like, about everybody not eating meat. You know, seems to have a huge impact on the climate. And it seems like we're waiting for adaptation to solve these problems when there's no enforcement mechanism. I was wondering if you could follow up on that.
So really quickly, it turns out Hardin was wrong. So he thought, like, people just will have as many babies. They'll have, like, tons and tons of babies if they're not given a reason. But again, all you have to do is give them education, birth control, and then they don't have tons and tons of babies. Turns out.
All we have to do.
No, but it's the Hardin example. It's a great example, but it's also really misguided, insofar as he turned out to be wrong in a lot of empirical facts. So to get to your bigger question, I think it comes to this issue of who bears the responsibility, and this is a big debate in the climate ethics literature. And my own answer is that responsibility is overlapping, right? We certainly shouldn't be putting an overwhelming burden on individuals, right? We kind of find ourselves in these circumstances. I think there's some moral burden on individuals to change the way that they're living. But I think the biggest burdens lie with governments, right, and kind of higher kind of social orders, the higher you go up the social hierarchy. But it's overlapping, right? We can have responsibilities, and corporations can have responsibilities, and governments can have responsibilities. But in terms of, like, my hopefulness about adaptation, I think we need to work towards global cooperation in order to have – we need a global system, because the to each her own approach isn't going to work insofar as, A, it's going to leave a lot of people suffering because they just can't do it. And it's going to turn out it's already those who are disadvantaged and who've been disadvantaged by the system that caused this in the first place. So from a justice perspective, it's very clear we need global cooperation, and we need the rich nations for many reasons, because they're the ones who caused the problem, because they have the ability to pay, because, right, a million other reasons we could, you know, there's 20 philosophical papers each giving different reasons. So we're going to really need some cooperation on this, and I have to be hopeful that we can move in that direction, right? I can't sleep otherwise.
It's okay.
Yeah. All right. Yes, ma'am.
Hi. I've been a photographer and a sailor, both locally and worldwide, since 1968. I don't think it was until about 2012 when somebody pointed up to the sky and said, "Do you know what you're photographing out there?" I had no idea. My research began, and I realized it was what they were calling chemtrails in the air. I went back, and I looked through my photographs, and I saw what I didn't see when I was taking pictures from 1968 till 2012. And I have taken hundreds, maybe into the thousands of photographs since then. And in my research, and what I have found is what is falling on us from those chemtrails in the air is aluminum, barium, and strontium, and that it is already happening. And if you don't believe it, go have your blood test for heavy metals, barium, aluminum, strontium. We have blood tests. We have water tests. We have soil tests. We have it all. It is happening. So I ask you, please get your noses out of the books, off the iPhones, out of your classrooms, and look at the elephant in the sky. And if you want to dismiss me, disbelieve me, go have your blood checked, because every one of us are breathing it in. Have your blood tests for aluminum, barium, and strontium. We all have it, and that's what's making us all sick.
Thank you very much for coming.
Can I make one response to that? I understand your passion about this issue, but what I don't understand is the way in which you and your colleagues denigrate the scientific community. You act as if we have never looked at the atmosphere. You act as if we've never tried to measure anything. You had your say, let me have mine. I'm a member of a science team that flies an instrument on a NASA satellite that measures clouds, measures the frequency and occurrence of clouds. We have 15 years of record, all right? I can show you that 15 years of record. We've analyzed it. There is no demonstrable change in cloud cover in those 15 years. I can take other satellite data sets, I can take other ground data sets, and I can show you the same thing. Your implication that we're not looking at this, that somehow or other we don't want to know, is completely at odds with the science that has been done. And you're standing up and denigrating the entire science community for sticking their heads in a book and not looking at the real world is simply insulting.
So I do want to end on a note, on a question, and we would call it the czar question. So if you could put a law in place that would help mitigate CO2 emissions and the whole world has to follow it, what would that be?
All right. We're just debating who has to go first. Last time, Lauren had to go first.
He gets to go first.
So this was originally the God question, and I changed it to the czar question. I always said I wanted to be the czar. I wanted to be the benevolent czar, and I was sure you'd all accept that. So my answer to this question is partly technical and partly sort of the nature of the will. There's a very nice website that was started a number of years ago by two guys at Princeton, and they talk about the wedges. And basically their strategy is if you want to change CO2 emissions, if you want to deal with a mitigation issue, there is no silver bullet. There's no one thing that you can do. Nor should we think that we're so smart that we can pick the best solution from the beginning. So what you do is you invest in a whole bunch of solutions. You start looking at renewable, you start looking at conservation, you start looking at some of these CO2 removal things we were talking about biochar and the rest. I'm going to use the N-word here, nuclear power. You start looking at these options, and you start investing in them, and you invest more in them every year, and eventually you let this investment choose which ones are going to be successful and which ones are not. But the secret to the method is you have to start now, and you have to be willing to invest in all the technologies and not pick one. So I wish we had done this. We actually started on a path like this when Jimmy Carter was president. Jimmy Carter's my man, all right? I know there's a lot of people who don't like Jimmy, but that guy was smart, and he was way ahead of his time.
That was my favorite president. Absolutely.
If we had kept doing what Jimmy started in terms of solar cells and wind power, we'd be a way different country than we are right now. So what I would do is to take a hunk of the budget and start investing it in these technologies. And I think, you know, if you want to get into the will part of, and that's the technology, the will part of this is that you have to sustain it. You can't go into this with the idea that we're going to have the solution in 2 years. As a scientist, I am totally frustrated with people who ask me, what are you going to accomplish this year? And I go, I don't know. You know, it's research. If I knew the answer, I wouldn't be doing it. But we have 5-year plans and we have 10-year plans, and you have to invest in these kinds of things. You have to have the will to sustain it. So that's my
investment,
but in multiple technologies. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Don't try and pick which are going to be successful. Invest in them all and let, you know, the market, if you will, the government, the research consortium, figure it out for you.
Great. Thanks. Lauren?
I think my only kind of twist on that would be I would really push for us to stop thinking of climate change as a separate question, because it's entangled in everything that we're dealing with in our world. So you probably have guessed what I'm going to say here by now. But I would say let's look for co-benefits wherever possible. Let's do the kinds of things that are going to make this world a better world, not just because of climate change, but because it reduces sexism and it reduces racism and it reduces all these bad isms in our world. There's so many things we can do that can fix all kinds of problems at once. So I would say let's take a really holistic picture. Let's get lots and lots of really smart people working on the problem, give them the money they need to work on the problem, and get them talking to each other so that we work on the problem and we think about the big picture constantly as we're implementing solutions and as we take, you know, chances and try a whole bunch of different things. It's not going to be one silver bullet. It's going to be a whole lot of different things. The one difference that I would say Tom and I have is I wouldn't necessarily trust our economic system as it's been functioning the last 50 years. Right? I might say we need to find other mechanisms to reward the people who are developing these technologies that doesn't just let the market drive the price of these technologies that are going to help solve our problems, because they're not going to get distributed around the world quick enough to deal with the time scales we need to solve the problem, which has its own exceptionally long time scale.
So. Great, thanks. And that is going to be our last word. Thank you both so much for being here today. And thank you all for contributing to this conversation. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to this podcast of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. If you liked what you heard, you could leave a good review. It'll help other listeners find us. University of Washington professors Lauren Hartzell Nichols and Thomas Ackerman spoke at Columbia City's Royal Room on June 30th, 2015. Humanities Washington's Zaki Barak Hamid served as moderator. Thanks again to Kevin Mitchum for our recording. Tune in next week for more great talks. For Speakers Forum, KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm John O'Brien.